is off wherever, in New York or whatever, thinking I did something I would never do. I shot a look to Ben. Ben shot a look back to me. I have to run to class, I said. But why do you say she's in New York? I guess she told Jace like 2 days before she left that New York was the only place in America where a person could actually live a halfway livable life. Maybe she was just saying it. I don't know. Okay, I gotta run, I said. I knew Ben would never convince Lacey to go to prom with him, but I figured he at least deserved the opportunity. I jogged through the halls toward my locker, rubbing Radar's head as I ran past him. He was talking to Angela and a freshman girl in band. Don't thank me, thank you. I heard him say to the freshman, and she called out, Thank you for my $200! Without looking back, I shouted, Don't thank me, thank Margot Roth Spiegelman! Because, of course, she had given me the tools I needed. I made it to my locker and grabbed my calc notebook, but then I just stayed, even after the second bell rang, standing still in the middle of the hallway while people rushed past me in both directions, like I was the median in their freeway. Another kid thanked me for his $200. I smiled at him. The school felt more mine than in all of my 4 years there. We'd gotten a measure of justice for the bikeless band geeks. Lacey Pemberton had spoken to me. Chuck Parson had apologized. I knew these halls so well, and finally, it was starting to feel like they knew me, too. I stood there as the third bell rang and the crowds dwindled. Only then did I walk to Kelk, sitting down just after Mr. Jimenez had started another interminable lecture. I had brought Margot's copy of Leaves of Grass to school, and I started reading the highlighted parts of Song of Myself again, under the desk, while Mr. Jimenez scratched away at the blackboard. There were no direct references to New York that I could see. I handed it to Radar after a few minutes, and he looked at it for a while before writing on the corner of his notebook closest to me, The green highlighting must mean something. Maybe she wants you to open the door of your mind? I shrugged and wrote back, Or maybe she just read the poem on two different days with two different highlighters. A few minutes later, as I glanced toward the clock for only the 37th time, I saw Ben Starling standing outside the classroom door, a hall pass in his hand, dancing a spastic jig. When the bell rang for lunch, I raced to my locker, but somehow Ben had beaten me there, and somehow he was talking to Lacey Pemberton. He was crowding her, slumping slightly so he could talk toward her face. Talking to Ben could make me feel a little claustrophobic sometimes, and I wasn't even a hot girl. Hey, guys, I said when I got up to them.
Hey,
Lacey answered, taking an obvious step back from Ben.
Ben was just bringing me up to date on Margot. No one ever went into her room, you know. She said her parents didn't allow her to have friends over.
Really? Lacey nodded. Did you know that Margot owns, like, 1,000 records? Lacey threw up her hands.
No, that's what Ben was saying. Margot never talked about music. I mean, she would say she liked something on the radio or whatever, but no, she's so weird.
I shrugged. Maybe she was weird, or maybe the rest of us were weird. Lacey kept talking.
But we were just saying that Walt Whitman was from New York. And according to Omnictionary, Woody Guthrie lived there for a long time, too, Ben said.
I nodded. I can totally see her in New York. I think we have to figure out the next clue, though. It can't end with a book. There must be some code in the highlighted lines or something.
Yeah. Can I look at it during lunch?
Yeah, I said. Or I can make you a copy in the library if you want.
Nah, I can just read it. I mean, I don't know crap about poetry. Oh, but anyway, I have a cousin in college there at NYU, and I sent her a flyer she could print. So I'm going to tell her to put them up in record stores. I mean, I know there are a lot of record stores, but still.
Good idea, I said. They started to walk to the cafeteria, and I followed them.
Hey, Ben asked Lacey, what color is your dress?
It's kind of sapphire. Why?
Just want to make sure my tux matches, Ben said.
I'd never seen Ben smile so giddy ridiculous, and that's saying something, because he was a fairly giddy ridiculous person. Lacey nodded.
Well, but we don't want to be too matchy-matchy. Maybe if you go traditional, black tux and black vest?
No cummerbund, you don't think?
Well, they're okay, but you don't want to get one with really fat pleats, you know?
They kept talking,
Apparently, the ideal level of pleat fatness is a conversational topic to which hours can be devoted. But I stopped listening as I waited in the Pizza Hut line. Ben had found his prom date, and Lacey had found a boy who would happily talk prom for hours. Now everyone had a date. Except me, and I wasn't going. The only girl I'd want to take was off tramping some kind of perpetual journey or something. When we sat down, Lacey started reading Song of Myself, and she agreed that none of it sounded like anything, and certainly none of it sounded like Margot. We still had no idea what, if anything, Margot was trying to say. She gave the book back to me, and they started talking about prom again. All afternoon, I kept feeling like it wasn't doing any good to look at the highlighted quotes. But then I would get bored and reach into my backpack and put the book on my lap and go back to it. I had English at the end of the day, seventh period, and we were just starting to read Moby Dick, so Dr. Holden was talking quite a lot about fishing in the 19th century. I kept Moby Dick on the desk and Whitman in my lap. But even being in English class couldn't help. For once, I went a few minutes without looking at the clock, so I was surprised by the bell ringing and took longer than everyone else to get my backpack packed. As I slung it over one shoulder and started to leave, Dr. Holden smiled at me and said, "Walt Whitman, huh?" I nodded sheepishly. "Good stuff," she said. "So good that I'm almost okay with you reading it in class, but not quite." I mumbled sorry and then walked out to the senior parking lot. While Ben and Radar banded, I sat in Rawpaw with the doors open, a slow, husky breeze blowing through. I read from the Federalist Papers to prepare for a quiz I had the next day in government, but my mind kept returning to its continuous loop, Guthrie and Whitman and New York and Margot. Had she gone to New York to immerse herself in folk music? Was there some secret folk music-loving Margot I had never known? Was she maybe staying in an apartment where one of them had once lived? And why did she want to tell me about it? I saw Ben and Radar approaching in the side-view mirror, Radar swinging his sax case as he walked quickly toward Rawpaw. They hustled in through the already open door, and Ben turned the key and Rawpaw sputtered, and then we hoped, and then she sputtered again, and then we hoped some more, and finally she gurgled to life. Ben raced out of the parking lot and turned off campus before saying to me, "Can you believe this shit?" He could hardly contain his glee. He started hitting the car's horn, but of course the horn didn't work, so every time he hit it, he just yelled, "Beep! Beep! Beep! Honk if you're going to prom with True Blue Honey Bunny Lacey Pemberton! Honk, baby, honk!" Ben could hardly shut up the whole way home. "You know what did it, aside from desperation? I guess she and Becca Arrington are fighting because Becca's, you know, a cheater, and I think she started to feel bad about the whole Bloody Ben thing. She didn't say that, but she sort of acted it. So in the end, Bloody Ben is going to get me some palehi." I was happy for him and everything, but I wanted to focus on the game of getting to Margot. "Do you guys have any ideas at all?" It was quiet for a moment, and then Radar looked at me through the rearview mirror and said, "That doors thing is the only one marked different from the others, and it's also the most random. I really think that's the one with the clue. What is it again?" "Unscrew the locks from the doors. Unscrew the doors themselves from their jams," I replied. "Admittedly, Jefferson Park is not really the best place to unscrew the doors of closed-mindedness from their jams," Radar allowed. "Maybe that's what she's saying, like the Paper Town thing she said about Orlando. Maybe she's saying that's why she left." Ben slowed for a stoplight and then turned around to look at Radar. "Bro," he said, "I think you guys are giving Margot Honeybunny way too much credit." "How's that?" I asked. "Unscrew the locks from the doors," he said. "Unscrew the doors themselves from their jams." "Yeah," I said. The light turned green and Ben hit the gas. Rawpaw shuddered like she might disintegrate, but then began to move. "It's not poetry. It's not metaphor. It's instructions. We are supposed to go to Margot's room and unscrew the lock from the door and unscrew the door itself from its jam." Radar looked at me in the rearview mirror, and I looked back at him. "Sometimes," Radar said to me, "he's so retarded that he becomes kind of brilliant." Chapter 6. After parking in my driveway, we walked across the strip of grass that separated Margot's house from mine, just as we had Saturday. Ruthie answered the door and said her parents wouldn't be home until 6. Myrna Mountain Weasel ran excited circles around us. We went upstairs. Ruthie brought us a toolbox from the garage, and then we all stared at the door leading to Margot's bedroom for a while. We were not handy people.
"What the hell are you supposed to do?"
asked Ben.
"Don't curse in front of Ruthie," I said.
"Ruthie, do you mind if I say hell?"
"We don't believe in hell,"
she said by way of answering. Radar interrupted.
"People," he said. "People, the door."
Radar dug out a Phillips head screwdriver from the mess of a toolbox and knelt down, unscrewing the locking doorknob. I grabbed a bigger screwdriver and tried to unscrew the hinges, but there didn't seem to be any screws involved. I looked at the door some more. Eventually, Ruthie got bored and went downstairs to watch TV. Radar got the doorknob loose, and we each, in turn, peered inside at the unpainted, unfinished wood around the knob. No message. No note. Nothing. Annoyed, I moved on to the hinges, wondering how to open them. I swung the door open and shut, trying to understand its mechanics.
"That poem is so damned long," I said.
"You'd think old Walt could have taken a line or two to tell us how to unscrew the door itself from its jam." Only when he responded did I realize Radar was sitting at Margot's computer.
"According to Omnictionary," he said, "we're looking at a butt hinge, and you just use the screwdriver as a lever to pop out the pin. Incidentally, some vandal has added that butt hinges function well because they are powered by farts. Oh, Omnictionary, wilt thou ever be accurate?"
Once Omnictionary had told us what to do, doing it proved surprisingly easy. I got the pin off each of the three hinges, and then Ben pulled the door away. I examined the hinges and the unfinished wood of the doorway. Nothing.
"Nothing on the door,"
Ben said. Ben and I placed the door back in place, and Radar pounded in the pins with the screwdriver's handle. Radar and I went over to Ben's house, which was architecturally identical to mine, to play a game called Arctic Fury. We were playing this game within a game, where you shoot each other with paintballs on a glacier. You received extra points for shooting your opponents in the balls. It was very sophisticated.
"Bro, she's definitely in New York City,"
Ben said. I saw the muzzle of his rifle around a corner, but before I could move, he shot me between the legs.
"Shit,"
I mumbled.
Radar said, "In the past, it seems like her clues have pointed to a place. She tells Jace she leaves us clues involving two people who both lived in New York City most of their lives. It does make sense."
Ben said,
"Dude, that's what she wants."
Just as I was creeping up on Ben, he paused the game. "She wants you to go to New York.
What if she arranged to make that the only way to find her? To actually go?"
"What? It's a city of like 12 million people."
"She could have a mole here," Radar said, "who will tell her if you go."
"Lacey," Ben said. "It's totally Lacey. Yes! You gotta get on a plane and go to New York City right now. And when Lacey finds out, Margot will pick you up at the airport. Yes! Bro, I am going to take you to your house, and you're gonna pack, and then I'm driving your ass to the airport, and you're gonna put a plane ticket on your emergencies-only credit card, and then, when Margot finds out what a badass you are, the kind of badass Jace Worthington only dreams about being, all three of us will be taking hotties to prom."
I didn't doubt there was a flight to New York City leaving shortly. From Orlando, there's a flight to everywhere leaving shortly. But I doubted everything else. "If you call Lacey," I said.
"She's not going to confess,"
Ben said.
"Think of all the misdirection they used. They probably only acted like they were fighting so you wouldn't suspect she was the mole."
Radar said,
"I don't know. That doesn't really add up."
He kept talking, but I was only half listening. Staring at the paused screen, I thought it over. If Margot and Lacey were fake fighting, did Lacey fake break up with her boyfriend? Had she faked her concern? Lacey had been fielding dozens of emails, none with real information, from the flyers her cousin had put in record stores in New York. She was no mole, and Ben's plan was idiotic. Still, the mere idea of a plan appealed to me. But there were only 2.5 weeks left of school, and I'd miss at least 2 days if I went to New York. Not to mention my parents would kill me for putting a plane ticket on my credit card. The more I thought about it, the dumber it was. Still, if I could see her tomorrow... But no.
"I can't miss school,"
I finally said. I unpaused the game.
I have a French quiz tomorrow.
You know, Ben said, your romanticism is a real inspiration.
I played for a few more minutes and then walked across Jefferson Park back home. My mom told me once about this crazy kid she worked with. He was a completely normal kid until he was 9, when his dad died. And even though, obviously, a lot of 9-year-olds have had a lot of dead fathers, and most of the time the kids don't go crazy, I guess this kid was an exception. So what he did was he took a pencil and one of those steel compass things, and he started drawing circles onto a piece of paper. All the circles exactly 2 inches in diameter. And he would draw the circles until the entire piece of paper was completely black. And then he would get another piece of paper and draw more circles. And he did this every day, all day, and didn't pay attention in school and drew circles all over all of his tests and shit. And my mom said that this kid's problem was that he had created a routine to cope with his loss, only the routine became destructive. So anyway, then my mom made him cry about his dad or whatever, and the kid stopped drawing circles and presumably lived happily ever after. But I think about the circles kid sometimes, because I can sort of understand him. I always liked routine. I suppose I never found boredom very boring. I doubted I could explain it to someone like Margot, but drawing circles through life struck me as a kind of reasonable insanity. So I should have felt fine about not going to New York. It was a dumb idea anyway. But as I went about my routine that night and the next day at school, it ate away at me, as if the routine itself was taking me farther from reuniting with her. Chapter 7 Tuesday evening, when she had been gone 6 days, I talked to my parents. It wasn't a big decision or anything, I just did. I was sitting at the kitchen counter while Dad chopped vegetables and Mom browned some beef in a skillet. Dad was razzing me about how much time I'd spent reading such a short book, and I said, "Actually, it's not for English. It seems like maybe Margot left it for me to find." They got quiet, and then I told them about Woody Guthrie and the Whitman. "Well, she clearly likes to play these games of incomplete information," my dad said. "I don't blame her for wanting attention," my mom said, and then to me added, "But that doesn't make her well-being your responsibility." Dad scraped the carrots and onions into the skillet. "Yeah, true. Not that either of us could diagnose her without seeing her, but I suspect she'll be home soon." "We shouldn't speculate," my mom said to him quietly, as if I couldn't hear or something. Dad was about to respond, but I interrupted. "What should I do?" "Graduate," my mom said, "and trust that Margot can take care of herself, for which she has shown a great talent." "Agreed," my dad said. But after dinner, when I went back to my room and played Resurrection on mute, I could hear them talking quietly back and forth. I could not hear the words, but I could hear the worry. Later that night, Ben called my cell. "Hey," I said.
"Bro,"
he said. "Yes," I answered.
"I'm about to go shoe shopping with Lacey."
"Shoe shopping?"
"Yeah, everything's 30% off from 10 to midnight. She wants me to help her pick out her prom shoes. I mean, she had some, but I was over at her house yesterday and we agreed that they weren't, you know, you want the perfect shoes for prom. So she's gonna return them and then we're going to Burdine's and we're going to, like, pick..."
"Ben," I said.
"Yeah?"
"Dude, I don't want to talk about Lacey's prom shoes. And I'll tell you why. I have this thing that makes me really uninterested in prom shoes. It's called a penis.
I'm really nervous, and I can't stop thinking that I actually kind of really like her, not just in the she's a hot prom date way, but in the she's actually really cool, and I like hanging out with her kind of way. And, like, maybe we're going to go to prom, and we'll be, like, kissing in the middle of the dance floor, and everybody will be like, holy shit, and, you know, everything they ever thought about me will just go out the window."
"Ben," I said, "stop the dork babble, and you'll be fine." He kept talking for a while, but I finally got off the phone with him. I lay down and started to feel a little depressed about prom. I refused to feel any kind of sadness over the fact that I wasn't going to prom, but I had, stupidly, embarrassingly, thought of finding Margot and getting her to come home with me just in time for prom, like late on Saturday night, and we'd walk into the Hilton ballroom wearing jeans and ratty t-shirts, and we'd be just in time for the last dance. And we'd dance while everyone pointed at us and marveled at the return of Margot, and then we'd foxtrot the hell out of there and go get ice cream at Friendly's.
So yes, like Ben, I harbored ridiculous prom fantasies. But at least I didn't say mine out loud. Ben was such a self-absorbed idiot sometimes, and I had to remind myself why I still liked him. If nothing else, he sometimes got surprisingly bright ideas. The door thing was a good idea. It didn't work, but it was a good idea. But obviously, Margot had intended it to mean something else to me. To me. The clue was mine. The doors were mine. On my way to the garage, I had to walk through the living room where Mom and Dad were watching TV. "Want to watch?" my mom asked. "They're about to crack the case." It was one of those solve-the-murder crime shows. "No, thanks," I said, and breezed past them through the kitchen and into the garage. I found the widest flathead screwdriver and then stuck it in the waistband of my khaki shorts, cinching my belt tight. I grabbed a cookie out of the kitchen and then walked back through the living room, my gait only slightly awkward, and while they watched the televised mystery unfold, I removed the three pins from my bedroom door. When the last one came off, the door creaked and started to fall, so I swung it all the way open against the wall with one hand, and as I swung it, I saw a tiny piece of paper, about the size of my thumbnail, flutter down from the door's top hinge. Typical Margot. Why hide something in her own room when she could hide it in mine? I wondered when she had done it, how she'd gotten in. I couldn't help but smile. It was a sliver of the Orlando Sentinel, half straight edges and half ripped. I could tell it was the Sentinel because one ripped edge read, "Doe Sentinel, May 6, 2. The day she had left. The message was clearly from her. I recognized her handwriting. 8328 Bartlesville Avenue. Lowercase b, capital A. I couldn't put the door back on without beating the pins back into place with the screwdriver, which would have definitely alerted my parents, so I just propped the door on its hinges and kept it all the way open. I pocketed the pins and then went to my computer and looked up a map of 8328 Bartlesville Avenue. I had never heard of the street. It was 34.6 miles away, way the hell out Colonial Drive, almost to the town of Christmas, Florida. When I zoomed in on the satellite image of the building, it looked like a black rectangle fronted by dull silver and then grass behind. A mobile home, maybe? It was hard to get a sense of scale because it was surrounded by so much green. I called Ben and told him. "So I was right," he said. "I can't wait to tell Lacey because she totally thought it was a good idea, too." I ignored the Lacey comment. "I think I'm going to go," I said. "Well, yeah, of course you gotta go. I'm coming. Let's go on Sunday morning. I'll be tired from all-night prom partying, but whatever." "No, I mean, I'm going tonight," I said. "Bro, it's dark. You can't go to a strange building with a mysterious address in the dark. Haven't you ever seen a horror movie?" "She could be there," I said. "Yeah, and a demon who can only be nourished by the pancreases of young boys could also be there," he said. "Christ, at least wait until tomorrow, although I've got to order her corsage after band. Oh, and then I want to be home in case Lacey IMs, because we've been IMing a lot of..." I cut him off. "No, tonight, I want to see her." I could feel the circle closing. In an hour, if I hurried, I could be looking at her. "Bro, I'm not letting you go to some sketchy address in the middle of the night. I will tase your ass if necessary." "Tomorrow morning," I said, mostly to myself. "I'll just go tomorrow morning." I was tired of having perfect attendance anyway. Ben was quiet. I heard him blowing air between his front teeth. "I do feel a little something coming on," he said. "Fever, cough, aches, pains." I smiled. After I hung up, I called Radar. "I'm on the other line with Ben," he said. "Let me call you back." He called back a minute later. Before I could even say hello, Radar said, "Q, I got this terrible migraine. There's no way I can go to school tomorrow." I laughed. After I got off the phone, I stripped down to T-shirt and boxers, emptied my garbage can into a drawer, and put the can next to the bed. I set my alarm for the ungodly hour of 6 a.m. and spent the next few hours trying in vain to fall asleep. Chapter 8. Mom came into my room the next morning and said, "You didn't even close the door last night, sleepyhead." And I opened my eyes and said, "I think I have a stomach bug." And then I motioned toward the trash can, which contained puke.
"Quentin! Oh, goodness! When did this happen?"
"About 6,
I said, which was true.
Why didn't you come get us?
Too tired, I said, which was also true.
You just woke up feeling ill?
She asked.
Yeah,
I said, which was untrue. I woke up because my alarm went off at 6, and then I snuck into the kitchen and ate a granola bar and some orange juice. 10 minutes later, I stuck 2 fingers down my throat. I didn't want to do it the night before because I didn't want it stinking the room up all night. The puking sucked, but it was over quickly. Mom took the bucket, and I could hear her cleaning it out in the kitchen. She returned with a fresh bucket, her lips pouting with worry.
Well, I feel like I should take the day,
she started, but I cut her off.
I'm honestly fine, I said. Just queasy. Something I ate.
Are you sure?
I'll call if it gets worse,
I said. She kissed my forehead. I could feel her sticky lipstick on my skin. I wasn't really sick, but still, somehow she had made me feel better.
Do you want me to close the door?
She asked, one hand on it. The door clung to its hinges, but only barely.
No, no, no,
I said, perhaps too nervously.
Okay,
she said. I'll call school on my way to work. You let me know if you need anything. Anything. Or if you want me to come home. And you can always call Dad, and I'll check up on you this afternoon. Okay? I nodded, and then pulled the covers back up to my chin. Even though the bucket had been cleaned, I could smell the puke underneath the detergent, and the smell of it reminded me of the act of puking, which for some reason made me want to puke again. But I just took slow, even mouth breaths until I heard the Chrysler backing down the driveway. It was 7:32. For once, I thought, I would be on time. Not to school, admittedly, but still. I showered and brushed my teeth and put on dark jeans and a plain black T-shirt. I put Margot's scrap of newspaper in my pocket. I hammered the pins back into their hinges and then packed. I didn't really know what to throw into my backpack, but I included the door jamb opening screwdriver, a printout of the satellite map, directions, a bottle of water, and in case she was there, the Whitman. I wanted to ask her about it. Ben and Radar showed up at 8 on the dot. I got in the back seat. They were shouting along to a song by the Mountain Goats. Ben turned around and offered me his fist. I punched it softly, even though I hated that greeting.
Q! He shouted over the music. How good does this feel?
And I knew exactly what Ben meant. He meant listening to the Mountain Goats with your friends in a car that runs on a Wednesday morning in May on the way to Margot and whatever Margotastic prize came with finding her.
It beats calculus,
I answered. The music was too loud for us to talk. Once we got out of Jefferson Park, we rolled down the one window that worked so the world would know we had good taste in music. We drove all the way out Colonial Drive, past the movie theaters and the bookstores that I had been driving to and past my whole life. But this drive was different and better because it occurred during calculus, because it occurred with Ben and Radar, because it occurred on our way to where I believed I would find her. And finally, after 20 miles, Orlando gave way to the last remaining orange tree groves and undeveloped ranches. The endlessly flat land grown over thick with brush, the Spanish moss hanging off the branches of oak trees, still in the windless heat. This was the Florida where I used to spend mosquito-bitten, armadillo-chasing nights as a Boy Scout. The road was dominated now by pickup trucks, and every mile or so you could see a subdivision off the highway. Little streets winding for no reason around houses that rose up out of nothing like a volcano of vinyl siding. Farther out, we passed a rotting wooden sign that said Grove Point Acres. A cracked blacktop road lasted only a couple hundred feet before dead-ending into an expanse of gray dirt, signaling that Grove Point Acres was what my mom called a pseudo-vision, a subdivision abandoned before it could be completed. Pseudo-visions had been pointed out to me a couple of times before on drives with my parents, but I had never seen one so desolate. We were about 5 miles past Grove Point Acres when Radar turned down the music and said,
"Should be in about a mile."
I took a long breath. The excitement of being somewhere other than school had started to wane. This didn't seem like a place where Margot would hide or even visit. It was a far cry from New York City. This was the Florida you fly over, wondering why people ever thought to inhabit this peninsula. I stared at the empty asphalt, the heat distorting my vision. Ahead, I saw a strip mall wavering in the bright distance.
"Is that it?"
I asked, leaning forward and pointing.
"Must be," Radar said.
Ben pushed the power button on the stereo, and we all got very quiet as Ben pulled into a parking lot long since reclaimed by the gray sandy dirt. There had once been a sign for these four storefronts. A rusted pole stood about 8 feet high by the side of the road, but the sign was long gone, snapped off by a hurricane or an accumulation of decay. The stores themselves had fared little better. It was a single-story building with a flat roof, and bare cinder block was visible in places. Strips of cracked paint wrinkled away from the walls, like insects clinging to a nest. Water stains formed brown abstract paintings between the store windows. The windows were boarded up with warped sheets of particle board. I was struck by an awful thought, the kind that cannot be taken back once it escapes into the open air of consciousness. It seemed to me that this was not a place you go to live. It was a place you go to die. As soon as the car stopped, my nose and mouth were flooded with the rancid smell of death. I had to swallow back a rush of puke that rose up into the raw soreness in the back of my throat. Only now, after all this lost time, did I realize how terribly I had misunderstood both her game and the prize for winning it. I get out of the car, and Ben is standing next to me, and Radar next to him. And I know all at once that this isn't funny, that this hasn't been proved to me you're good enough to hang out with me. I can hear Margot that night as we drove around Orlando. I can hear her saying to me, "I don't want some kids to find me swarmed with flies on a Saturday morning in Jefferson Park." Not wanting to be found by some kids in Jefferson Park isn't the same thing as not wanting to die. There is no evidence that anyone has been here in a long time except for the smell, that sickly, sour stench designed to keep the living from the dead. I tell myself, she can't smell like that, but of course she can. We all can. I hold my forearm up to my nose so I can smell sweat and skin and anything but death.
"Margot!"
Radar calls. A mockingbird perched on the rusted gutter of the building spits out two syllables in response.
"Margot!"
he shouts again. Nothing. He digs a parabola into the sand with his foot and sighs.
Shit.
Standing before this building, I learned something about fear. I learned that it is not the idle fantasies of someone who maybe wants something important to happen to him, even if the important thing is horrible. It is not the disgust of seeing a dead stranger, and not the breathlessness of hearing a shotgun pumped outside of Becca Arrington's house. This cannot be addressed by breathing exercises. This fear bears no analogy to any fear I knew before. This is the basis of all possible emotions, the feeling that was with us before we existed, before this building existed, before the earth existed. This is the fear that made fish crawl out onto dry land and evolve lungs, the fear that teaches us to run, the fear that makes us bury our dead. The smell leaves me seized by desperate panic. Panic not like my lungs are out of air, but like the atmosphere itself is out of air. I think maybe the reason I've spent most of my life being afraid is that I have been trying to prepare myself, to train my body for the real fear when it comes. But I am not prepared.
"Bro, we should leave," Ben says. "We should call the cops or something."
We have not looked at each other yet. We are all still looking at this building, this long-abandoned building that cannot possibly hold anything but corpses.
"No," Radar says. "No, no, 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 no. We call if there's something to call about. She left the address for Q, not for the cops. We have to find a way in there."
"In there?"
Ben says dubiously. I clap Ben on the back, and for the first time all day, the three of us are looking not forward, but at one another. That makes it bearable. Something about seeing them makes me feel as if she is not dead until we find her. "Yeah, in there," I say. I don't know who she is anymore, or who she was, but I need to find her. Chapter 9. We walk around the back of the building and find four locked steel doors and nothing but ranch land, patches of palmettos dotting an expanse of gold-green grass. The stench is worse here, and I feel afraid to keep walking. Ben and Radar are just behind me, to my right and left. We form a triangle together, walking slowly, our eyes scanning the area.
"It's a raccoon!"
Ben shouts.
"Oh, thank God! It's a raccoon! Jesus!"
Radar and I walk away from the building to join him near a shallow drainage ditch.
A huge, bloated raccoon with matted hair lies dead. No visible trauma. Its fur falling off, one of its ribs exposed. Radar turns away and heaves, but nothing comes out. I lean down next to him and put my arm between his shoulder blades, and when he gets his breath back, he says, "I am so fucking glad to see that dead fucking raccoon." But even so, I cannot picture her here alive. It occurs to me that the Whitman could be a suicide note. I think about things she highlighted. To die is different from what anyone supposed, and luckier. I bequeath myself to the dirt to grow from the grass I love. If you want me again, look for me under your boot soles. For a moment, I feel a flash of hope when I think about the last line of the poem. I stop somewhere waiting for you. But then I think that the I does not need to be a person. The I can also be a body. Radar has walked away from the raccoon and is tugging on the handle of one of the four locked steel doors. I feel like praying for the dead, saying Kaddish for this raccoon, but I don't even know how. I'm so sorry for him, and so sorry for how happy I am to see him like this.
"It's given a little," Radar shouts to us. "Come help!"
Ben and I both put our arms around Radar's waist and pull back. He puts his foot up against the wall to give himself extra leverage as he pulls, and then all at once, they collapse onto me, Radar's sweat-soaked T-shirt pressed up against my face. For a moment, I'm excited, thinking we're in, but then I see Radar holding the door handle. I scramble up and look at the door, still locked.
"Piece of shit 40-year-old goddamn doorknob," Radar says.
I've never heard him talk like this before. "It's okay," I say. "There's a way. There has to be." We walk all the way around to the front of the building. No doors, no holes, no visible tunnels. But I need in. Ben and Radar try to peel the slabs of particle board from the windows, but they're all nailed shut. Radar kicks at the board, but it doesn't give. Ben turns back to me.
"There's no glass behind one of these boards," he says,
and then he starts jogging away from the building, his sneakers splashing sand as he goes. I give him a confused look.
"I'm going to bust through the particle board," he explains.
"You can't do that." He is the smallest of our light trio. If anyone tries to smash through the boarded-up windows, it should be me. He balls his hands into fists and then extends his fingers out. As I walk toward him, he starts talking to me.
"When my mom was trying to keep me from getting beat up in third grade, she put me in Taekwondo. I only went to, like, 3 classes, and I only learned one thing, but the thing comes in handy sometimes. We watched this Taekwondo master punch through a thick wooden block, and we were all like, 'Dude, how did he do that?' And he told us that if you move as though your hand will go through the block, and if you believe that your hand will go through the block, then it will."
I'm about to refute this idiotic logic when he takes off, running past me in a blur. His acceleration continues as he approaches the board, and then utterly, without fear, he leaps up at the last possible second, twists his body sideways, his shoulder out to bear the brunt of the force, and slams into the wood. I half expect him to burst through and leave a Ben-shaped cutout like a cartoon. Instead, he bounces off the board and falls onto his ass in a patch of bright grass amid the sea of sandy dirt. Ben rolls onto his side, rubbing his shoulder.
"It broke," he announces.
I assume he means his shoulder as I race toward him, but then he stands up and I'm looking at a Ben-high crack in the particle board. I start kicking at it, and the crack spreads horizontally, and then Radar and I get our fingers inside the crack and start tugging. I squint to keep the sweat from burning my eyes and pull with all my force back and forth until the crack starts to make a jagged opening. Radar and I urge it on with silent work until eventually he has to take a break and Ben replaces him. Finally, we are able to punch a big chunk of the board into the mini-mall. I climb in, feet first, landing blindly onto what feels like a stack of papers. The hole we've carved into this building gives a little light, but I can't even make out the dimensions of the room or whether there is a ceiling. The air in here is so stale and hot that inhaling and exhaling feel identical. I turn around and my chin hits Ben's forehead. I find myself whispering, even though there's no reason to.
"Do you have a..." "No,"
he whispers back before I can finish.
"Radar, did you bring a flashlight?"
I hear Radar coming through the hole.
"I have one on my keychain. It's not much, though."
The light comes on, and I still can't see very well, but I can tell we've stepped into a big room filled with a labyrinth of metal shelves. The papers on the floor are pages from an old day-by-day calendar, the days scattered through the room, all of them yellowing and mouse-bit. I wonder if this might once have been a little bookstore, although it's been decades since these shelves held anything but dust. We fall into line behind Radar. I hear something creak above us, and we all stop moving. I try to swallow the panic. I can hear each of Radar's and Ben's breaths, their shuffling footsteps. I want out of here, but that could be Margot creaking for all I know. It could also be crack addicts.
"Just the building settling,"
Radar whispers, but he seems less sure than usual. I stand there, unable to move. After a moment, I hear Ben's voice.
"The last time I was this scared, I peed myself." "The last time I was this scared," Radar says, "I actually had to face a Dark Lord in order to make the world safe for wizards."
I made a feeble attempt.
"The last time I was this scared, I had to sleep in Mommy's room."
Ben chuckles.
"Q, if I were you, I would get that scared every single night."
I'm not up for laughing, but their laughter makes the room feel safer, so we begin to explore. We walk through each row of shelves, finding nothing but a few copies of Reader's Digest from the 1970s lying on the floor. After a while, I find my eyes adjusting to the darkness, and in the gray light, we start walking in different directions at different speeds. "No one leaves the room until everyone leaves the room," I whisper, and they whisper okays back. I get to a side wall of the room and find the first evidence that someone has been here since everyone left. A jagged, semicircular, waist-high tunnel has been cut out of the wall. The words "Troll Hole" have been spray-painted in orange above the hole, with a helpful arrow pointing down to the hole.
"Guys,"
Radar says, so loud that the spell breaks for just a moment. I follow his voice and find him standing by the opposite wall, his flashlight illuminating another troll hole. The graffiti doesn't look particularly like Margot's, but it's hard to tell for sure. I've only seen her spray paint a single letter. Radar shines the light through the hole as I duck down and lead the way through. This room is entirely empty, except for a rolled carpet in one corner. As the flashlight scans the floor, I can see glue stains on the concrete from where the carpet had once been. Across the room, I can just make out another hole cut into the wall, this time without the graffiti. I crawl through that troll hole into a room lined with clothing racks, the stainless steel poles still bolted into walls wine-stained with water damage. This room is better lit, and it takes me a moment to realize it's because there are several holes in the roof. Tar paper hangs down, and I can see places where the roof sags against exposed steel girders.
"Souvenir store,"
Ben whispers in front of me, and I know immediately he is right. In the middle of the room, five display cases form a pentagon. The glass that once kept the tourists from their tourist crap has mostly been shattered and lies in shards around the cases. The gray paint peels off the wall in odd and beautiful patterns, each cracked polygon of paint a snowflake of decay. Strangely, though, there's still some merchandise. There's a Mickey Mouse phone I recognize from some way back part of childhood. Mothbit but still folded Sunny Orlando t-shirts are on display, splattered with broken glass. Beneath the glass cases, Radar finds a box filled with maps and old tourist brochures advertising Gator World and Crystal Gardens and funhouses that no longer exist. Ben waves me over and silently points out the green glass alligator tchotchke lying alone in the case, almost buried in the dust. This is the value of our souvenirs, I think. You can't give this shit away. We make our way back through the empty room and the shelved room and crawl through the last troll hole. This room looks like an office, only without computers, and it appears to have been abandoned in a great hurry, like its employees were beamed up to space or something. 20 desks sit in four rows. There are still pens on some of the desks, and they all feature oversized paper calendars lying flat against the desks. On each calendar, it is perpetually February of 1986. Ben pushes a cloth desk chair, and it spins, creaking rhythmically. Thousands of post-it notes advertising the Martingale Mortgage Corporation are piled beside one desk in a rickety pyramid. Open boxes contain stacks of paper from old dot matrix printers, detailing the expenses and income of the Martingale Mortgage Corporation. On one of the desks, someone has stacked brochures for subdivisions into a single-story house of cards. I spread the brochures out, thinking that they may hold a clue, but no. Radar fingers through the papers, whispering,
"Nothing after 1986.
I start to go through the desk drawers. I find Q-tips and stick pins. Pens and pencils packed a dozen each in flimsy cardboard packaging with retro fonts and design. Napkins. A pair of golf gloves.
"Do you guys see anything," I ask, "that gives any hint that anyone has been here in the last, say, 20 years?
"Nothing but the troll holes,"
Ben answers. "It's a tomb, everything wrapped in dust."
"So why did she lead us here?"
asked Radar. We are speaking now. "Don't know," I say. "She is clearly not here."
"There are some spots," Radar says, "with less dust. There's a dustless rectangle in the empty room, like something was moved, but I don't know."
"And there's that painted part," Ben says.
Ben points, and Radar's flashlight shows me that a piece of the far wall in this office has been brushed over with white primer, like someone got the idea to remodel the place but abandoned the project after half an hour. I walk over to the wall, and up close, I can see that there's some red graffiti behind the white paint. But I can only see occasional hints of the red paint bleeding through, not nearly enough to make anything out. There's a can of primer up against the wall, open. I kneel down and push my finger into the paint. There's a hard surface, but it breaks easily, and my finger comes up drenched in white. As the paint drips off my finger, I don't say anything, because we've all come to the same conclusion, that someone has been here recently after all. And then the building creaks again, and Radar drops the flashlight and curses.
"This is freaky," he says.
"Guys,"
Ben says. The flashlight is still on the ground, and I take a step back to pick it up, but then I see Ben pointing. He is pointing at the wall. A trick of the indirect light has made the graffiti letters float up through the coat of primer, a ghost gray print I recognize immediately as Margot's. "You will go to the paper towns, and you will never come back." I pick up the flashlight and shine it on the paint directly, and the message disappears. But when I shine it against a different part of the wall, I can read it again.
"Shit,"
Radar says under his breath. And now Ben says,
"Bro, can we go now? Because the last time I was this scared..." "Screw it. I'm freaked out. There's nothing funny about this shit."
"There's nothing funny about this shit" is the closest Ben can come to the terror I feel, maybe. And it is close enough for me. I fast walk toward the troll hole. I can feel the walls closing in on us. Chapter 10. Ben and Radar dropped me off at my house. Even though they'd skipped school, they couldn't afford to skip band practice. I sat alone with Song of Myself for a long time. And for about the 10th time, I tried to read the entire poem, starting at the beginning. But the problem was that it's like 80 pages long and weird and repetitive, and although I could understand each word of it, I couldn't understand anything about it as a whole. Even though I knew the highlighted parts were probably the only important parts, I wanted to know whether it was a suicide note kind of poem. But I couldn't make sense of it. I was 10 confusing pages into the poem when I got so freaked out that I decided to call the detective. I dug his business card out of a pair of shorts in the laundry hamper. He answered on the second ring. "Warren."
"Hi, it's Quentin Jacobson. I'm a friend of Margot Roth-Spiegelman."
"Sure, kid. I remember you. What's up?" I told him about the clues and the mini-mall, and about paper towns, about how she had called Orlando a paper town from the top of the SunTrust building, but she hadn't used it in the plural, about her telling me that she wouldn't want to be found, about finding her underneath our boot soles. He didn't even tell me not to break into abandoned buildings, or ask why I was at an abandoned building at 10 a.m. on a school day. He just waited until I stopped talking and said, "Jesus, kid. You're almost a detective. All you need now is a gun, a gut, and 3 ex-wives. So, what's your theory?"
"I'm worried that she might have, killed herself."
"It never crossed my mind that this girl did anything but run off, kid. I can see your case, but you gotta remember, she's done this before. The clues, I mean. Adds drama to the whole enterprise. Honestly, kid, if she wanted you to find her, dead or alive, you already would have." But don't you, kid? The unfortunate thing is that she's a legal adult with free will, you know? Let me give you some advice. Let her come home. I mean, at some point, you gotta stop looking up at the sky. Well, one of these days, you'll look back down and see that you floated away, too. I hung up with a bad taste in my mouth. I realized it wasn't Warren's poetry that would take me to Margot. I kept thinking about those lines at the end Margot had underlined. I bequeath myself to the dirt to grow from the grass I love. If you want me again, look for me under your boot soles. That grass, Whitman writes in the first few pages, is the beautiful uncut hair of graves. But where were the graves? Where were the paper towns? I logged onto Omnictionary to see if it knew anything more about the phrase paper towns than I did. They had an extremely thoughtful and helpful entry created by a user named Skunkbutt. A paper town is a town that's got a paper mill in it. This was the shortcoming of Omnictionary. The stuff written by Radar was thorough and extremely helpful. The unedited work of Skunkbutt left something to be desired. But when I searched the whole web, I found something interesting buried 40 entries down on a forum about real estate in Kansas. Looks like Madison Estates isn't going to get built. My husband and I bought property there, but someone called this week to say they're refunding us our deposit because they didn't pre-sell enough houses to finance the project. Another paper town for Kansas. Marge in Cawker, Kansas. A pseudo-vision. You will go to the pseudo-visions and you will never come back. I took a deep breath and stared at the screen for a while. The conclusion seemed inescapable. Even with everything broken and decided inside her, she couldn't quite allow herself to disappear for good, and she had decided to leave her body, to leave it for me, in a shadow version of our subdivision, where her first strings had broken. She had said she didn't want her body found by random kids, and it made sense that out of everyone she knew, she would pick me to find her. She wouldn't be hurting me in a new way. I'd done it before. I had experience in the field. I saw that Radar was online and was clicking over to talk to him when an IM from him popped up on my screen. I'm Nictionarian 96. Hey. Cue the resurrection. Paper towns equal pseudovisions. I think she wants me to find her body because she thinks I can handle it, because we found that dead guy when we were kids. I sent him the link. I'm Nictionarian 96. Slow down. Let me look at the link. Q the resurrection. K. I'm Nictionarian 96.
Okay, don't be so morbid. You don't know anything for sure. I think she's probably fine.
Q the resurrection.
No, you don't.
I'm Nictionarian 96.
Okay, I don't. But if anybody's alive in the face of this evidence...
Q the resurrection.
Yeah, I guess. I'm gonna go lie down. My parents get home soon.
But I couldn't calm down, so I called Ben from bed and told him my theory.
Pretty morbid shit, bro. But she's fine. It's all part of some game she's playing.
You're being kind of cavalier about it, he sighed.
Whatever. It's a little lame of her to, like, hijack the last 3 weeks of high school, you know? She's got you all worried, and she's got Lacey all worried. And prom is in, like, 3 days, you know? Can't we just have a fun prom?
Are you serious? She could be dead, Ben.
She's not dead. She's a drama queen. Wants attention. I mean, I know her parents are assholes, but they know her better than we do, don't they? And they think so, too.
You can be such a tool, I said.
Whatever, bro. We both had a long day. Too much drama. I'll TTYS.
I wanted to ridicule him for using chatspeak IRL, but I found myself lacking the energy. After I hung up with Ben, I went back online, looking for a list of pseudovisions in Florida. I couldn't find a list anywhere, but after searching abandoned subdivisions and Grove Point Acres and the like for a while, I managed to compile a list of 5 places within 3 hours of Jefferson Park. I printed out a map of Central Florida, tacked the map to the wall above my computer, and then added a tag for each of the 5 locations. Looking at the map, I could detect no pattern among them. They were randomly distributed among the far-flung suburbs, and it would take me at least a week to get to all of them. Why hadn't she left me a specific place? All these scary-as-hell clues. All this intimation of tragedy.
but no place. Nothing to hold on to, like trying to climb a mountain of gravel. Ben gave me permission to borrow Rawpaw the next day, since he was going to be driving around prom shopping with Lacey in her SUV. So for once, I didn't have to sit outside the band room. The seventh period bell rang, and I raced out to his car. I lacked Ben's talent for getting Rawpaw to start, so I was one of the first people to arrive at the senior parking lot and one of the last to leave. But finally, the engine caught, and I was off to Grove Point Acres. I drove out of town on Colonial, driving slowly, watching for any other pseudovisions I might have missed online. A long line of cars trailed behind me, and I felt anxious about holding them up. I marveled at how I could still have room to worry about such petty, ridiculous crap as whether the guy in the SUV behind me thought I was an excessively cautious driver. I wanted Margot's disappearance to change me, but it hadn't, not really. As the line of cars snaked behind me like some kind of unwilling funeral procession, I found myself talking out loud to her. I will play out the string. I will not betray your trust. I will find you. Talking like this to her kept me calm, strangely. It kept me from imagining the possibilities. I came again to the sagging wooden sign for Grove Point Acres. I could almost hear the sighs of relief from the bottleneck behind me as I turned left onto the dead-end asphalt road. It looked like a driveway without a house. I left Rawpaw running and got out. From close up, I could see that Grove Point Acres was more finished than it initially appeared. Two dirt roads ending in cul-de-sacs had been cut into the dusty ground, although the roads had eroded so much I could barely see their outlines. As I walked up and down both streets, I could feel the heat in my nose with each breath. The scalding sun made it hard to move, but I knew the beautiful, if morbid, truth. Heat made death reek, and Grove Point Acres smelled like nothing except cooked air and car exhaust. Our cumulative exhalations held close to the surface by the humidity. I looked for evidence she had been there, footprints or something written in the dirt or some memento, but I seemed to be the first person to walk on these unnamed dirt streets in years. The ground was flat, and not much brush had grown back yet, so I could see for a ways in every direction. No tents, no campfires, no Margot. I got back in Rawpaw and drove to I-4 and then went northeast of town, up to a place called Holly Meadows. I drove past Holly Meadows three times before I finally found it. Everything in the area was oak trees and ranch land, and Holly Meadows, lacking a sign at its entrance, didn't stand out much. But once I drove a few feet down a dirt road through the initial roadside stand of oak and pine trees, it was every bit as desolate as Grove Point Acres. The main dirt road just slowly evaporated into a field of dirt. There were no other roads that I could make out, but as I walked around, I did find a few spray-painted wooden stakes lying on the ground. I guessed that they had once been lot line markers. I couldn't smell or see anything suspicious, but even so, I felt a fear standing on my chest, and at first I couldn't understand why, but then I saw it. When they had clear-cut the area to build, they had left a solitary live oak tree near the back of the field. And the gnarled tree, with its thick, barked branches, looked so much like the one where we had found Robert Joyner in Jefferson Park that I felt sure she was there, on the other side of the tree. And for the first time, I had to picture it. Margot Roth Spiegelman, slumped against the tree, her eyes silent, the black blood pouring out of her mouth, everything bloated and distorted because I had taken so long to find her. She had trusted me to find her sooner. She had trusted me with her last night, and I had failed her. And even though the air tasted like nothing but it might rain later, I was sure I had found her. But no, it was only a tree, alone in the empty silver dirt. I sat down against the tree and let my breath come back. I hated doing this alone. I hated it. If she thought Robert Joyner had prepared me for this, she was wrong. I didn't know Robert Joyner. I didn't love Robert Joyner. I hit at the dirt with the heels of my fists and then pounded it again and again, the sand scattering around my hands until I was hitting the bare roots of the tree, and I kept it up, the pain shooting up through my palms and wrists. I had not cried for Margot until then, but now finally I did. Pounding against the ground and shouting because there was no one to hear,
I missed her. I missed her. I missed her. I miss her. I stayed there, even after my arms got tired and my eyes dried up, sitting there and thinking about her until the light got gray.
Chapter 11. The next morning at school, I found Ben standing beside the band door talking to Lacey, Radar,